This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Supermarket, written and directed by Bobby Hall. Read by the author.
Part 1, Chapter 1, The Beginning of the End. So this is how it feels to take a man's life, forced to kill for one's own survival. I look down at the puddle of blood by my feet, locking eyes with my own reflection. Fluorescent lights flickered overhead. How did I get here? I was just a dude who worked at a grocery store. Now here I was, standing over a man I murdered. I guess in that moment it was attempted murder. He was still desperately gasping for air, sucking in his last breaths. But there was no doubt about it, he was dying a violent death and experiencing every moment of it. In the mornings when I left my apartment for work, sometimes I would hold the elevator door for Mrs. Huffle. She was a sweet woman in her 70s. Say the elevator stopped and some sick game began where only one of us could leave the box alive. Would she kill me to survive? Would she have it in her to pull the trigger and meet her friend Dolores in time for brunch? Man, I think about shit like that all the time. Too much, I suppose. The funny part is I always thought of myself as such a good guy, you know? Someone who would do anything to avoid confrontation. What the fuck happened? This wasn't me. But none of this was as it seemed to be, quite honestly. The blood on my hands smelled metallic. It reminded me of when my uncle would work on his truck. I must have been 3 years old. You know when you smell something and it takes you back in an instant? Back to a memory as vivid as the voice you're listening to this very moment, even though you haven't thought about it since your brain shelved it decades ago. I was brought back to reality by the feeling of blood crawling down my forearms. It dripped onto the floor from my fingertips like a faucet when a child doesn't shut it off after brushing their teeth. It was thick like maple syrup, but not sticky, more like red coffee creamer. Planting my knee on the ground, I reached into the pocket of the dying man's button-down. I took out his pack of cigarettes and silver Zippo. I forced a few cigs from the pack with an upward jolt, snatching one with my lips so I didn't stain the butt with blood. The man was wheezing now, inhaling in intervals like someone heaving during a nightmare. Maybe that's just what this was. A nightmare. I mean, to be honest, none of it felt real except for the blinding pain from the open wound on my head. And that's when he spoke.
Flynn, you were doing so well.
Bubbles popped from his blood-covered lips. Flicking the lid of the Zippo, I tried to light my cigarette to no avail. "Mm-hmm," I muttered as I struck it again, this time igniting the cigarette. I noticed the words Vanilla Sky engraved on the top of the lighter. This immediately made me think of the Paul McCartney song. I brought my cigarette to the man's lips. "There you go," I said. "Now puff." I could hear sirens and fire trucks in the distance. The blood from his lips stained the butt of the cigarette like a single mother driving an Astro van in the early 1990s, picking up her fifth-grade son from soccer practice with that poofy hair and shoulder pad look. You know the one.
"This is all Lola's fault, you know," he said.
"I know," I said. He laughed until the pain in his chest forced out a groan, reminding us both of the whole dying thing happening.
"Flynn, what's my... last name?"
"I don't know," I said. "I told you that already."
"Flynn, did we have fun?" he asked.
"You ruined my life."
Chapter 2, Daydream.
I guess the story starts 3 years ago in a small town in Oregon. I suppose every goddamn town in Oregon is small as far as towns go. Baker City,
White as fuck. Surprise, surprise. Not far from Idaho. Barely 50 kids in my graduating class. You know what that means? Everyone knew everyone else's business. Dated the same people, went to the same lame parties, ate at the same broke diner. We had a bank, a post office, a library, a supermarket, and a dirty old movie theater that screened Marvel flicks. No mall, no good restaurants, no hospital, no shit to do, really. The most fun you could have was floating down the river with some whiskey and beers. Most people wouldn't want to spend more than a day there. I don't blame them. But it was all right. I didn't have much of a choice now, did I? Being born there and everything. I didn't exactly excel at school. I was more interested in chasing girls and listening to music. The only class I paid any attention in was English. Reading and writing came naturally. I actually enjoyed it. The rest was a struggle or of zero interest. Most kids were into sports, but that wasn't really my scene. After high school, I dicked around, really. I did a year at community college because my mom forced me to do something. But that was a non-starter. I spent most of my time drinking and smoking. A lot of my friends got out of town, but me, I was stuck. The days turned into weeks, the weeks into months, the months into years. I don't know how it happened, but it happened. Time flew. Now here I was, 24, unemployed, depressed from a recent breakup, and living in my childhood room. I know what you're thinking. Pathetic, right? I don't disagree. Trust me, it wasn't where I wanted to be in life. In a series of fortunate events, I had come across some money. I was about to be fresh out of my mother's house for the first time in my life. My mom never had money, so this was a welcome windfall, however small. It was a nice little amount, enough to help me get my own apartment, but not enough to last me long. That's why I was on my way to apply for a job at the supermarket. I needed a gig, something, anything. And Baker City wasn't exactly the land of opportunity. 24 years old and bagging groceries isn't the most ideal situation, but it was real life, and that's what I was looking for at that point. Real life. It was a beautiful day in April. The time was 12:36 p.m. exactly. I know because I wrote it down in my moleskin notebook. That thing was beat to hell, but it had become my best friend. Everywhere I went, the moleskin came with. It had real character. It had lived a life. Black, pocket size, roughed up edges, dog-eared pages, with scraps of paper and photos stuffed inside. I wrote everything down in that notebook, recording my thoughts and the world around me. The fir trees swayed that day as the wind caressed each branch, molding their bodies in movement. I'll never forget crossing the road in front of the grocery store. I saw this guy in black Nike Air Maxes, blue Levi's, and a white t-shirt. He seemed to be forcibly talking at people who walked by, and not in a welcoming way. As I got closer, I realized he was kind of weird-looking, a little twisted, contorted, like he was out of an Egon Schiele drawing, mid-20s, on the tall side, maybe 6'1", slim. He had a long, bent nose, dark eyes, expressive eyebrows, and wrinkles in his forehead like Hugh Laurie. You know, that guy who plays House. I don't mean like a grown man sitting in front of a plastic tea set talking to a lifeless teddy bear, pretending to be a husband, droning on to his wife about the report his boss demanded be on his desk by Monday, even though, when his boss first mentioned it, the deadline was Tuesday, and now he would have to work through the weekend. I mean the actor who plays a doctor named House on a television show. No? You don't know what I'm talking about? I can't tell if you don't know what I'm talking about or if you're just taken aback by my breaking the fourth wall on this page I'm reading. Well, damn. Hold on a second. Maybe I shouldn't bring up the fact that I'm reading you a book. If you realize what you're literally doing in this moment, then you won't actually be living in the world that I'm painting for you. It's kind of like when you catch yourself blinking while reading, and then you start to focus on your blinking rather than the words your brain is trying to process, you know? Oh, shit. I've distracted myself. Wait, what was I talking about? And why in the hell am I writing my internal thoughts on this page? Doesn't matter. This won't make the final version of the book anyway. But what the hell was I talking about? Shit. Oh, yeah, sorry. The weirdo in front of the supermarket. As I got closer and closer, I tried to avoid him, but he spotted me immediately. Kind of like when you catch your own reflection in the tinted windows of the automatic sliding doors. He was definitely a reflection. He seemed to mirror my movements a bit creepily. With every step I took, he took one too, until we met. "Spare a dollar?" he said. "Sorry, man, I don't have it on me," I said, patting my chest and pockets. "Help a brother out," he said, extending his hand. What the hell, I thought. They need to get rid of the beggars and loiterers. I walked past him, bringing my hands to my backpack straps as I entered the store. I absolutely loved my backpack. It came everywhere with me and became my trademark. It was a gray Herschel pack with a brown leather bottom. It was covered in pins. Rick and Morty, Mac DeMarco, Atari, Pac-Man, an old keychain I'd had since I was a kid dangled from the outside zipper. One of those ones with your name on it that you buy at a gas station. I know, I'm a little old for all that, but my grandma got it for me and it's become my good luck charm. Inside, the place looked like your typical grocery store. Tiled floors, jammed up carts, aisles and aisles of neatly stacked food, buzzing fluorescent lights. It was a little run down, but clean enough for the families in town. I immediately noticed the volume of beautiful girls who worked at this place. Damn. Definitely college girls trying to make an extra buck during the semester, I thought. Walking through the front checkout area, I made my way to the customer service desk, where I asked a middle-aged black woman for an application. Her name tag said Rhonda. She was kind of like the slightly overweight black woman in every movie. Sassy attitude, lowered eyelids, and judgmental aura. But basing a first impression on her physical appearance really wasn't a fair thing to do. I mean, how can you judge someone simply by, "You applying for a job dressed in blue jeans and a white shirt, child?" When she said this, I was actually glad my gut was right, and I wasn't some prejudiced asshole. Well, not completely anyway. "Well, Rhonda, I only came in like this to fill out the application. I didn't plan on sitting down for an interview the same day." She stared at me and let out a single chuckle, one of those, "I'm annoyed, but this is my job" chuckles, and said, "You know how often I hear that, baby? How many times I've had this conversation? Those pretty brown eyes of yours aren't going to take you that far." Wow. I could only imagine how many idiots came in here just like me, dressed like they didn't care, to apply for a job they didn't give two shits about. But I needed this job. If I didn't get this job, that would be it. My ex would be right, just as she'd always been. I was destined to be a loser who couldn't finish anything. "Hey there, friend," a man said. I turned around to a grinning man in his early 30s. He extended his hand to be shaken, as if he wasn't going to take no for an answer. "I'm Ted Daniels, assistant manager here." He looked like a corny white dude, pale skin with a dash of acne held over from his teenage years, buzz-cut flat top, short-sleeved button-down, red tie, and black pleated slacks, the ultimate nerd. "Hello there," I said, mimicking his attitude as best I could, trying not to think about how he looked like a Mormon who joined the Los Angeles Bloods after 2 years of mission work down in South Central, throughout Crenshaw and Compton, and was now sporting a bright red tie just to prove how gangster he really was. "I'm Flynn," I added.
"And are we applying for employment today?" he said.
His smile never seemed to go away, even when he spoke. Yeah, I mean, I saw that you guys were hiring, and I wanted to fill out an application."
"Well, golly gee, aren't we in luck," he said.
It really annoyed me how happy he was. His whole vibe bothered me. I have no idea what overcame me, but I snapped and punched him in the face. My fist connected with his nose, and blood spewed from the slit created by the explosive blow.
"Oh, Lord Jesus, these white people done did it," Rhonda screamed.
Ted hit the floor screaming in agony.
"Why?"
he bellowed. I stood there frozen. I couldn't believe what I had done. Something just came over me. How the hell could I have done such a thing?
"Are you listening to me?" he screamed. "Why? Why, Flynn?"
Seconds later, I was sitting in an old wooden chair in Ted's office. Ted sat behind his desk. His nose was perfectly fine.
"Flynn, are you listening to me?" Ted said.
I'm sorry, sir. What was that last part? I had imagined the whole thing, caught in a daydream so vivid I didn't even remember making my way to his office. I said, "Why, Flynn?" he said, annoyed but still smiling bigger than ever. "I'm sorry, sir. Why what now?" I replied. "Why are you here, Flynn? Do you even know why you're here? Everyone is family at this establishment. We have a code of ethics, you could say. We want to help everyone under this roof acquire whatever skills their individual needs may be. So what truly brings you, Flynn? What skills do you need?" A second ago, I was surely headed to jail for assault, and now I found myself in the middle of a job interview. "A job," I said. "Well, aren't we a wise one?" Ted said with a laugh. "You're in luck. A bunch of the seniors here are graduating, and we will need some extra hands come summer. You seem like a nice kid, so I'd love to hire you." "Seriously?" I said. I hadn't done shit to deserve this offer. Maybe it was my pretty face. "The job is yours," Ted said as he reached under his desk. "That is, if you can sell me this bottle of Windex." I couldn't see his lips through his smile. I looked at the bottle of Windex, then looked back at Ted. "So you're telling me if I sell you this thing, I have a job?" I asked.
"Precisely," Ted said.
Without a moment's hesitation, I grabbed my backpack, which was resting against the leg of my chair. I opened the pouch, grabbed my wallet, and took out a $20 bill. I then licked Andrew Jackson's face and slapped the federal note against the bottle, sticking it to its surface. "Buy this bottle of cleaner as is for $5, I said to Ted. He looked at me puzzled.
"Wait a minute. You're losing money here, Flynn."
"Look, Ted, would you buy this product from me or not?" I said with a smirk.
"Well, of course. But why would you throw away $15 like that?"
"The way I see it," I interrupted, "I just spent $15 to secure a steady income for the duration of my time as an employee at this establishment, boss." Ted was baffled. He wasn't sure if I had pulled a fast one on him or if I'd given him exactly what he wanted. But judging by his next words, he was definitely intrigued.
"You're hired," he said,
offering his hand for me to shake.
"Seriously?"
I said, not believing it.
"Oh, of course, Flynn. I really believe in energy, and I have a good feeling about you."
"Well, thanks, Ted. That means a lot," I said, unsure why this guy was so eager to give me a position. "Wait a second," I said. "What would I be doing and how much money would I be making?"
"Oh, $10 an hour, and you'll be our floater."
"I'll be a what?"
"I'll explain everything on Monday. See you at 9 a.m., he said, pointing to the calendar on his desk.
With that, I was out of his office and walking past customer service, gainfully employed. "See you later, Rhonda," I said.
"Mm-hmm,"
Rhonda replied with that fierce, strong black woman attitude. I loved Rhonda's attitude. She gave no fucks, quite honestly, and I absolutely adored her for it. On my way out, just beside the customer service desk, I spotted a soda machine by the automatic doors. A few employees were loitering. They seemed to be doing everything but their jobs. I pulled out my wallet, searching for a bill to insert into the machine. A picture fell out. A picture of me sitting in the park on a summer day, my arms around a beautiful blonde girl, a girl who broke my heart, a girl I was still in love with. She sat in my lap, looking into my eyes. We were in a field of grass. The shutter had caught us mid-laugh. It was some Hallmark shit, and she looked stunning. I picked up the photo and put it in the pocket of my jacket. "Fucking bitch," I said. I pulled out my dollar and inserted it into the machine. A can of Coke dropped. As I stood back up, I heard a voice behind me.
"So, I'm guessing you just magically found that dollar you didn't have 15 minutes ago when I asked you for one, huh?"
It was the weirdo from outside. He stared at me nonchalantly, with brown eyes set back by dark circles. He looked like he needed a good night's sleep. He was chewing on a toothpick and bouncing a red rubber ball, the kind people play handball with.
I stammered.
Well, you make me sick, dude, you dick.
What if I were homeless? You don't know,"
he said, pulling an apron over his head. It revealed a name tag that said Frank.
"Wait a minute. You're a fucked up person, man, he interrupted.
But I...
Hey, you, said Ted Daniels, looking in Frank's direction. Back to work, please. We're on the clock.
The group of employees behind Frank walked off to whatever it was they should have been doing.
And none of that from you on Monday,
he said, looking at me with a smile. Then he did an abrupt about-face and scooted off.
You work here? I asked.
Yeah, dude. I'm just fucking with you, man, said Frank. Wait a second, I said, staring at Frank puzzled. You work here and you stand outside asking people for money? Well, I don't know how much work I do, he said with a wry smile, making air quotation marks with his hands. And plus, when I stand outside, people walk right by me. You were the only one who even said something and didn't just stare right through me. So thanks for being the only person who acknowledges my existence in this place. I'll see you on Monday, Frank, I said.
Oh shit, did Ted just hire you? He asked.
Yeah, I guess he did.
Cool, well, I'm out. I'm gonna go try to fuck one of these college girls, Frank said,
walking in the direction of the college chicks working the cash registers.
Catch you later, Flynn.
He tossed me his rubber ball as I waved. I nearly dropped it trying to catch it, then began to walk out of the store. I stopped in my tracks.
Wait a sec,
I said, turning around to ask him how he knew my name. But before I could, he was gone.
See you Monday, Rhonda, I said on my way out.
Not if Jesus answers my prayers and takes me in my sleep this weekend, baby.
I wasn't sure if she was playing or serious. Either way, Rhonda was pretty dark.
Oh, shit. Wait, does that sound racist? I didn't mean dark like, you know, like her skin tone, because I think all women are beautiful, you know? Like, I mean, I have my preference, sure. I like blonde girls with big tits, you know? I'm a guy in his mid-20s from the, like, whitest town in existence. I mean, I'm not saying whites stick together or anything, but fuck. When I said Rhonda was dark, I meant her sense of humor, okay? Not her skin color.
Shit, man. Can we just skip to Monday already?
Chapter 3. Monday already. It felt as if all I did was blink and there Monday was. There I was, standing in front of the supermarket, bouncing my red rubber ball. I wasn't sure what to expect from my first day. I was just happy to have the job. I wasn't feeling particularly worried about it, nor was I feeling overly excited, just ready to get going. I needed the experience, and I needed the money. Heading in, I grabbed a few stray carts, trying to make a good first impression.
Hey, kid, said an old black man. He was sitting outside of the store playing chess.
Excuse me? I replied.
Where are you today?
He asked with a wise smile.
What are you talking about, old man?
He picked up a red knight and moved it up and to the right.
Where are you?
He demanded.
Where are we, right now?
Clearly at a supermarket. This guy's crazy, I thought.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Well, let's talk when you're actually back.
He turned back to his game, moving his bishop.
Okay, man,
I said, a little creeped out. I'd never seen someone play chess against himself. Guess this guy had a lot going on upstairs. I stared into the store from the outside. I spotted a few customers. One man stood clutching a cup of coffee, holding it to his nose, inhaling, muttering something to himself. Every time a customer would activate the sliding doors, I could faintly hear him,
coffee, 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 coffee.
Dude was into his Joe. Looking around, I saw other people, including Ted Daniels, the assistant manager, greeting customers.
Hello there, friend. Welcome,
he said with that unsettling smile. I'm not sure why he annoyed me the way he did. His smile was so constant that the front row of his teeth had become a permanent substitute for his lips. No one could be that happy all the time. There had to be something dark lurking behind that grin. The only time I caught him without it was when he was eating. Then he would only smile in intervals, between swallowing and reeling in his next bite. Something was off about him. He was a little too into his gig. You know when you work at a job in your teens and you really give it your all? You really go above and beyond and take pride in what you're doing,
until about 4 weeks in. Then you realize your job is completely demeaning, that your sole purpose is to blindly serve people who don't give two shits about your own happiness or future. Then your work ethic starts to slide. You walk into the break room asking yourself who the fuck aspires to be the best grocery bagger or cashier. Who the hell cares how fast you can change the oil at your local Jiffy Lube? Who's impressed that you can memorize the entire menu at the Crab Emporium seafood restaurant? I don't want to be a professional busboy, you think to yourself. Fuck this job. Then there's Ted. Ted is the guy who's been working for 15 years not only at the same chain but at the same goddamn location, and he's still only assistant manager. I mean, for fuck's sake. He's not even the manager, let alone the regional manager. Just think about that for a second. You spend 15 years at a company and you don't own the fucking place? Man, I've met some guys in my day who started working at McDonald's wiping the floors, then went on to fries, then burgers, then cashier, then shift manager, then store manager, and before you knew it, they were sitting down at the bank being accepted for a loan to become a franchisor. Not long after that, they got a seat at the board table. Real CEO shit, you know? But not Ted. Ted was the guy who wanted you to go nowhere and hate every second of it, because that's what he had done. Like most drones in our society, Ted never did what he really loved. He always made an excuse about how he would do it, but he had other obligations. But money was tight, but this or but that or, but you know how it is. People always say things like that. Well, I would, but... And that's where they fuck up. As soon as they give a reason for why they can't do something, they're already defeated. I mean, think about it. If you ask a bunch of people what they would do if money was no object, if they were sitting on $500 million in an account, the conversation typically goes like this. Well, I would definitely invest the money into a tech company or some kind of... This is where I would interrupt. No, I'd say. You're missing the point. The point is, what would you do if you had 500 million? Not what you would do with the 500 million. I would stare at them, waiting for the proper answer. The proper answer being whatever their fucking heart desired. Well, I guess... They would stammer. Here it comes, I would think to myself. Almost there. I guess I would probably travel, you know, see the world. Then go do that, I would reply. That's when they hit me with the money issues or their dying family member or needing to finish college or a million and one goddamn excuses we as a society give ourselves to rationalize our fears without having to face the unbearable, inevitable outcome of life. And that outcome is... What is death is imminent, Alex? Ding, 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 ding. Now, this is where I'd explain that if they wanted to see the world, travel to India, wave to the Queen's Palace in London, cross the Swiss Alps, ride elephants in Thailand, surf in Nicaragua, they could do it without question. And without asking how, they always seem to retort with some variation of, yeah, okay, buddy. It kills me every time. Are you serious? I would say. How the hell am I supposed to do all that? They'd reply. By using your head, I'd tell them. I mean, why not become a critic? They'd stare at me puzzled, then say something ignorant. What the hell do movies have to do with traveling? They'd say. Just like a drone with no mind of its own. I mean, this is some real break free from the Matrix shit we're talking about here. I didn't say a film critic, I said a critic. Why not review hotels across the globe? Once again, they'd stare, confused. Haven't you ever heard of a 5-star hotel? I'd ask. Well, of course, they'd reply. How do you think they got those stars in the first place? Their eyes would widen just enough for me to get through, and if their minds would open long enough, I could reach them. Think about it. You can do anything you want in life. It just takes persistence, determination, realism, and wanting success more than your next breath. Whatever you want in life, you can attain, as long as you believe it, as long as you say you're going to do it. Now, some of them, while still open-minded, would give some smart-ass response like, well, what if I want to be an astronaut?
I've had this conversation with kids under 10 as well as adults in their 60s. The only ones who ever asked me dismissive questions like this are the adults. It was the children who were perceptive. It was the children who took my words as affirmation of the limitless realities they already believed to be possible. They believed, in spite of the grown-ups around them, tainting their innocence and imagination while ripping them from their dreams. Dreams of walking on Mars or building jetpacks and teleportation machines. So to that smartass with the question, I would say yes. Yes, you can completely become an astronaut, I'd say. By then, I know they really mean a space traveler. I said persistence, determination, and realism earlier in my speech, I'd explain. If you look at your dream realistically, then becoming an astronaut is merely a $1 million SpaceX ticket, if you live long enough to see it. So all you really need to do is come up with the money to purchase such a golden ticket. This is where they would roll their eyes and lose interest. My point is that you asked how, and I'm giving you the examples, the possibilities. Because when I want something, truly want something that my life depends on, which is purpose and happiness, I will stop at nothing to attain it. It's like breathing. So you must ask yourself, what is your air? What is the thing you literally will fight for to survive? I would hear, wait a second. I was asking you what aisle the cereal was on. So how did we get here? Then they would walk away and I'd be reminded that all the shit I just philosophized goes down the drain when I'm surrounded by the reality of working in this goddamn supermarket. Wait, why was I talking about all this in the first place? Oh, yes, that's right. I was outside the supermarket looking at Ted, thinking about my hatred for his smile. Then, the next thing I knew, I was back, standing here, stocking a shelf with boxes of pasta, penne, ziti, spaghetti, pasta for days. A staticky voice sounded overhead.
Floater to break room? Floater to the break room, please.
The voice reminded me of the show MASH, about surgeons during the Korean War. There was always someone speaking over the intercom. I was a floater. As a floater, I didn't exactly have a job, but I didn't exactly not have one. I was the guy they told what to do and when to do it. Honestly, I didn't mind. It gave me more ground to cover and kept things varied and interesting. One minute, I'd be mopping up spilled cranberry juice. The other, I'd be facing cans. The other, I'd be walking old ladies' groceries to their cars. On my way to the break room, a woman from the store's pharmacy stopped me.
Well, hello there, Flynn.
Hey?
I'm Anne, silly. Don't forget to take your vitamins, she said, handing me 3 different types of supplements. It's important for your internal balance, she continued. I pretended to take them so as not to offend her. Into my right jacket pocket they went. I always rocked my brown suede bomber jacket. It was one of my prized possessions. All righty then, sweetheart, she said. See you tomorrow. And she was off.
Bye, I said, waving. This was an odd encounter, but I realized she was just the lady who was looking out for me, I guess. Maybe I reminded her of her son, or the son she never had. I never asked. Anne was in her late 60s, not fat, but not skinny, short, white curly hair, with a nurturing maternal vibe about her. That's why I didn't mind her giving me the vitamins, even if I wasn't going to take them. Truth is, I hated pills. Always had. Just trying to swallow them would make me throw up. I finally made it to the break room. Inside, 2 girls sat across from each other drinking coffee. One wore a name tag that said Rebecca, but the other girl called her Becca. Her counterpart's name tag said Rachel. I got out my moleskin and took notes. When I looked back, they were staring at me blankly as I stood motionless in the doorway.
New guy's a weirdo, huh?
Rachel said out loud, not holding back her rudeness. Staring directly at me, saying it like one of those college girls.
I'm hot and cool and don't give a fuck, but was probably molested at some point in my teenage years, so I'm always in defense mode and attack others before they can attack me first.
That kind of chick. You know the type. She looked oddly like Kat Dennings with her pale skin, big lips, bright red lipstick, bulging eyes, and dark brown hair that flowed over her shoulders onto her chest. She had a bit of a 1970s feel. Becca, on the other hand, seemed sweeter, a bit reserved and shy. She had an Emma Watson vibe going on, minus the hot accent.
"Are you lost, new guy?" Rachel said.
It reminded me of my first day in junior high, all the big kids already perfectly knowing the school layout, making fun of me while I'm reading off a sheet of paper looking for classroom A23 and hoping I won't be late for English. "They said they needed a floater to the break room," I said, looking away from Rachel. She didn't break eye contact, like a witch casting a spell. Quite honestly, it made me a little uncomfortable, but maybe I liked it. I couldn't tell.
"Must be in your head," she said,
the girls snickering like they were at a grade school lunch table. A shadowy figure entered the room behind me. It was Frank.
"Sup, Flynn," he said in a whisper.
"Hey, how do you know my name?" I said.
"I don't know your name, new guy,"
Rachel said in a smart-aleck tone. She and Becca stood up and started to leave. On her way out, Rachel stopped and flicked my name tag with her acrylic nail.
"See you later, Flynn," she said,
her tongue pressed against her cheek in a flirtatious manner. The two left the room. Frank nudged my elbow.
"I'm gonna fuck that girl," he said, "and her friend."
He pulled a banana out of his apron and peeled it. Standing there, confused and unanswered, I opened my mouth to ask again, but was cut off before the first syllable.
"Your name tag, dude," he said.
"Oh, yeah.
Duh,"
I said. "So how long have you worked here?"
"Long enough to have fucked every chick that's clocked into this motherfucker," he said,
hoisting himself onto the countertop. He peeled a banana, then spit it into the sink.
"What the fuck?"
I said, a little stunned.
"Well, not every chick. They come and go so often it's actually pretty hard to keep up," he continued, his mouth full of banana. "You know," he said, swallowing,
"most of these fucking girls are daddy's little princesses, off to college to become a grown-up." He took another bite. "And then," he continued, mouth so full I could barely make out what he was saying,
"the girls get a job here."
He chewed fiercely, swallowed, and continued, his words clearing up perfectly.
"And then they think, look at me, I'm a working girl," he explained, mimicking with his hands, "until they see that minimum wage check and realize daddy's credit card is king."
The room was awkwardly quiet. Light music from the store intercom bled in. It sounded like classic elevator music, soothing and unsettling at the same time.
"So bananas are your thing, huh?" I said.
"Bananas are your thing?" he repeated with a disrespected look on his face.
"What the fuck does that mean?"
he said.
"What are you, a fucking racist, huh? You saying bananas are my thing because I'm black?"
Frank was clearly white.
"Huh?" he demanded. "You fucking with me, Flynn?"
The faint sound of a Chuck Mangione flugelhorn solo filled the space between us.
"Nah, I'm just fucking with you, man," he said,
lifting his arms in the air. I exhaled, feeling my chest deflate like a balloon at a birthday party. How long had I been holding my breath in suspense?
"I wouldn't say bananas are my thing, but,"
he said, taking one final bite and raising the peel in the air like a basketball.
"Kobe,"
he said, taking a shot for the wastebasket. Airball.
"Ah, Shaq."
He looked at me.
"Not my thing, but they are a great source of nutrition for the brain. And the brain is super important, man,"
he said, motioning at me to come with him. He got up to exit the room. I hesitantly joined him, walking to the back loading dock by the dumpsters. Standing by the dumpster was a guy I hadn't met. There were so many people who worked here, too many for the size of the store. He looked to be in his late 20s, white and full of piercings. He had gauges, a nose ring, a bad Celtic tattoo peeking out of his sleeve, a leather wristband, a big-ass watch, and spiked green hair.
Yikes.
Not a good look. He stood, arms crossed, leaning against the top rail of a dumpster, smoking a cigarette.
"What's up? I'm Flynn," I said.
"Curtis,"
he said as he put out a fist. Pausing, I reluctantly met his fist with mine.
"I work in the deli,"
he said, not exactly the most sanitary looking of fellows. "Nice watch, where'd you get it?"
I asked him, trying to make small talk. Can I get a smoke? Frank blurted, interrupting. Get your own. Curtis put his pack of smokes in his tan button-down shirt pocket. A silver Zippo followed. The sunlight flashed across the surface of the lighter, revealing the words Vanilla Sky engraved on the top. He walked past me, flicking his cigarette. On his way by, he aggressively bumped into my shoulder, forcing me to drop the picture I'd been clutching in my pocket. It fell to the ground, right next to Curtis's still-burning cigarette.
Fuck that guy,
Frank said as he shamelessly picked up the butt to smoke.
Whoa, who's the babe?
He asked, grabbing the picture of me and my ex laughing in the park, madly in love on a summer day.
Oh, that's just this girl,
I said, pulling the red ball out of my pocket. I began to nervously bounce it.
Just this girl? This don't look like just this girl to me. This looks like a girl you put a baby in and locked down immediately,
he chuckled.
Trapper!
Yeah, well, that ship has unfortunately sailed, man. Let's just change the subject. I pulled out my pack of toothpicks and threw one in my mouth. Frank raised his eyebrows, as if to say,
okay,
but let it go.
So as I was saying, the brain is very important, Frank said, motioning with two fingers gripping the cigarette.
He pointed the tips of his index and middle fingers to his temple with his thumb cocked like a pistol.
And the lungs aren't? I asked, motioning to the cancer stick he was holding. That's different, man. This is addiction. You wouldn't know, he said, pointing to me.
Yes, I would, I said. I started smoking when I was 14, finally quit 6 months ago. Frank burst into laughter.
6 months? 6 months? You high and mighty motherfucker, talk to me in a year minimum, bro, he said,
inhaling deeply on what was left of the hand-me-down device of death.
6 months, he said, chuckling.
Yeah, whatever, I said.
Go on, what were you saying?
Frank paused.
Wait, he said. What the fuck was I saying?
We both paused for a moment. You know how it is. One of those moments when you and someone else are discussing something, but one of you gets off track, and for the life of you, you just can't seem to remember.
The brain, howled Frank,
completely satisfied with his discovery.
It's a powerful thing. From my research, bananas are some of the best brain food. They are packed with nutrients that help the mind function. You see, there are a lot of foods that are great for the brain. Walnuts, flax seeds, and avocado because of their omega acids and nutrients.
But bananas have been digested by us since we were swinging in the fucking trees, man. He was absurdly passionate about this banana.
Damn, man, you really know your shit, I said with a smile.
Well, one of us has to take care of your brain, he said as he grabbed another banana from the pouch in his black apron, the one he wore over his tan company-issued button-down. He threw the banana to me.
And you can take care of the lungs,
he said, waving a finger at me, mimicking a nagging old woman.
You see, bananas can also help with your mood in addition to your brain. Eating them can help you remember things.
By now we were inside walking through the store. I mean, without memory, who are we, you know? He asked. Just a shell of who we once were. With no memory, there's no self, there's no I. Is there consciousness without memory? Is there language? Experience? Without memory, are we just living in a loop? Is memory the only thing keeping us sane? Without memory, we're just walking around like that guy in Memento, scribbling shit on our arms, trying to figure out what the fuck is going on.
I said, you're giving that banana a lot of weight, man.
Think about it, Flynn. The mind is a powerful thing, Frank said, walking us around the store. We turned down the cereal aisle, where I saw a man wearing a white doctor's coat. He seemed to be a physician. But why was he shopping in his full getup? I had no idea.
Did you know one standard-sized banana provides approximately 0.4 milligrams of B6, 450 milligrams of potassium, 30 milligrams of magnesium, 30 grams of carbs, and 3 grams of fiber?
Frank continued as we walked. I looked over my shoulder and noticed that the doctor wasn't wearing his jacket anymore. He looked just like a regular customer now. I figured he must have placed his jacket inside his basket and carried on his merry way.
The facts on bananas are damn near endless, said Frank. Who the fuck would remember all that?
Somebody who eats a lot of bananas. Somebody who cares a lot about their mind, he said. That's when I realized Frank was perfect. I mean,
he was the ideal candidate. It was as if fate brought us together in this supermarket. I pulled out my moleskin and went down the list. On the left side of the page, it said, store/layout, medium size, checkout and customer service in front, produce section on the left, bakery, coffee shop, and pharmacy in the back. Company uniform, black pants, black shoes, light brown button-down t-shirt, black apron, and name tag. Possible characters, Becca, Rachel, Rhonda, Ted, Ann, Curtis. I added another name, Frank. Types of customers. A man who always drinks coffee. Let's call him Joe. Wacko, out front playing chess by himself. Mystery doctor, moms, grandmas. Different kinds of food. Canned goods, juice, pasta, cereal. Store gossip, love interest. On the right side of the page, another list. I went down it, checking items off, as Frank incessantly spoke in the background. Protagonist, kind of funny, check. Good with women, check. Smartass, check. Prick, check. Talker, check. Normal dude in 20s, check. He's perfect, I thought, biting into a banana as I strolled down aisle 9 with Frank by my side. Frank finally stopped talking, looking pleased about his deep knowledge of fruit. The crazy part about this list is these things were all expected to come from different people, and I could use other people's attributes to create a composite person. One person who was funny, another who was a smartass, another who was a bit of a womanizer. But hell, all these characteristics within one guy was a dream come true. It was all I could hope for when using a real-life person as the foundation for a fictional character. Oh, wait. Damn. I'm sorry. You must be confused. I'm a writer. I know my methods are unconventional, but that's what I was currently doing. Finishing a book. A book which I planned to base entirely on Frank. And I wasn't afraid to get weird with it. Actually, this seems even more confusing now. I think we should take a moment, step out of aisle 9, and take you back to the inception of all this. Give you a proper beginning. Chapter 4, A Proper Beginning. It's over, Flynn. My girlfriend Lola looked at me, her eyes welling up with tears. I love you, but I can't do this to myself anymore. It's sickening. Lola sat across from me inside our favorite booth at our favorite diner. She was the most beautiful I had ever seen her. Her blonde hair was pulled back into a bun. The afternoon sunlight crossed her face. The table was clear except for two coffees, napkins, sugar, and silverware. In case you aren't understanding how small this town is, it's so small that the sign over the diner we were sitting in literally just read, Diner. Are you listening to me, Flynn? She was not quite yelling, but she was extremely frustrated. In the kitchen, a cook placed two plates on the service counter separating the kitchen from the bar. Where's Francis, Amy, and Leslie? He shouted as the food started to die in the window. We've got customers waiting. The waitresses were about to reply when the missing waiter showed up. Sorry, Dave. I was out back on an important call, he said. He hurried over to our table, apologizing for the wait. He seemed so docile, your average white college kid. He had on black shoes, blue jeans, and a plain white t-shirt. I watched him tie his apron as fast as he could. He must have sensed that now wasn't the time to chat, so he just topped off our coffees. As he did, I examined his name tag, his facial features, his skin palette, his mannerisms, and the way he walked. He had wrinkles in his forehead, a long nose and high cheekbones, dark choppy hair, a sharp voice, and reserved body language. You know when you experience an intense moment and every mundane detail becomes extraordinarily vivid? And it turns into an unforgettable memory? This was like that. I never forgot this guy. Maybe it was because of what was going on. The love of my life was breaking up with me. This was emotionally traumatic. The entire scene was seared into my brain. Our mugs were red. Rings of coffee from her cup spotted the table. If you were staring at us from the side of our table, she was on the left and I was on the right. Our booth was next to a giant window. A little jukebox was fixed to the table. It took quarters. Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones played on the speakers.
Fuck, Flynn. I'm spilling my heart out to you in my final goodbye, and even now you can't give me anything?
She picked up a napkin from the table and dabbed her eyes. I hated to see her cry. It was the worst thing to me. But for whatever reason, I could never console her. I felt damaged in this way. Maybe it was from growing up without a father and never seeing a man treat my mother the way she should have been treated.
I mean, you're 24 for fuck's sake, and you live with your mother. You don't even have a job, Flynn.
I write.
You write? Is that some sick joke? Flynn, stop it. You aren't an author. You've never even finished a book. You send half-baked, unfinished ideas to publishers expecting book deals. What's wrong with you? It doesn't work that way. I mean, why do you think every company you send your ideas to replies with the same letter? Every time reiterating what I've been saying for years. Great promise, but finish the damn thing. You can't even keep a literary agent. They all drop you because you never deliver. You put your work ahead of me. You put your writing first in this relationship. You get so caught up in it that you lose touch with reality. I want to be with someone who is achieving their goals. I spent years by your side, Flynn, trying to help you, support you, encourage you, and grow with you. But no, you haven't changed one bit. You start amazing idea after amazing idea, but you never finish anything. And that's why I'm finishing this.
She grabbed her purse and exited the booth as fast as she could.
I don't ever want to see you again, Flynn.
My breath stopped. My chest tightened. The blood left my face. I vacantly stared downward, clasping my hands between my knees. Even though I appeared to be made out of stone, tears began to roll down my face. It was an emotionless, hollow cry. Seconds felt like hours. I tried to get up from the table, but my legs gave out and I collapsed back into the booth. I tried again, slowly rising from my table. I put on my coat and walked out of the diner. I jumped in my car and sped off. I looked in my rearview mirror. My face was tangled with emotion. Tears poured out. As I drove, I couldn't get an image out of my head. My car hydroplaning on the tears that fell from my face and flooded the streets, veering across lanes and crashing into the back of a garbage truck. Not wearing a seatbelt, I smashed through the windshield, shattering glass and landing twisted in the back of the empty truck. Then the compactor turned on, easily crushing my body into red paste. As the macabre daydream ended, my car sputtered out. I pushed the accelerator, but nothing happened. Out of gas, on the edge of town, I pulled over to the side of the road just under a bridge. This was truly nowhere. I opened the door, left the keys in the ignition, and ran. I ran and ran, not knowing why. I sprinted with what felt like an empty body, head tilted toward the blue sky, my throat burned, then my lungs, then my legs. My whole body felt as if it were on fire. I suppose I ran because I wanted to feel something. Anything. The blocks turned into miles, and the minutes into hours. My sprint turned into a wobbly jog. I stumbled off the street, collapsing into someone's front yard. I had no idea where I was. I lay there, my face pillowed by blades of grass, staring into the dirt. My mind empty, my lips salty from the snot and dried tears. I pushed myself up and knocked on the stranger's front door.
Hello? I'm sorry, may I use your phone?
I called my mother to pick me up.
What the fuck, Flynn? What happened?
My mom said when she arrived. I sat quietly in her car, motionless, my head erupting with a fever.
See, Flynn, this is what happens when you go running in the winter. Who the hell does something like this?
She said in a judgmental yet loving way. She continued to lecture, but the words began to fade, like hearing music from the outside of a nightclub, muffled and dark. Lola broke up with me, I said.
Oh, Flynn, no. I'm so sorry, she replied.
My mind snapped back to reality, and I finally thought about what had just happened. That's when it hit me. Everything Lola said was true. She'd always told me I worked too much.
that all I cared about was work. But since I never finished my work, it was in vain. She even tried to justify my actions, saying that if I had ignored her for a cause, if I had put our love aside for something greater than myself, it would be one thing. But I was living in a loop. My creative pursuits were all I had that brought me any joy. And I became fanatically devoted to my craft. It was my way of feeling complete. I would hole myself up for days on end. Wake up, coffee, cereal, write, lunch, write, dinner, write, sleep. Manuscripts piled up, littering my room. I would write, stream of consciousness, uninterrupted for hours, ignoring the world outside. It was a kind of mania. If I wasn't writing, I was lost and depressed. I would talk out loud to my fictional characters, figuring out dialogue. She believed that I was detaching myself from the real world through my stories, that I was spending more time with my characters than with her. She'd go on to say that the stories I wrote never ended, and because of this, it would never stop. She said every story needs an end, and that if there is no the end, then you cannot begin the next chapter. That's why I'm so determined to finish my novel this time. That's why it's going to be my best work. That's why I'm so damn happy to have met Frank, the perfect candidate to base my protagonist on. If I can't finish this, it's game over. I'm finally feeling ready, inspired, ambitious, focused. Before we get to that, let me explain the dark months that followed the breakup. The night of the breakup, after my mom brought me home, I lay in bed burning up, experiencing fever dreams and bizarre hallucinations. Phantom visions of Lola next to me, caressing my hair, then evaporating. My mother would periodically check in to make sure my fever wasn't what she would call ER-worthy. 2 days later, the fever had passed, but my depression hadn't. You know in the movies how they do that cool time lapse where hours on a clock spin by like seconds? Yeah, well, I want you to imagine that, but imagine each day feels like a second. I was disgusting. I barely left my bed. The lights never came on. I would hardly move, maybe to go to the bathroom, but even that felt like an impossible task. I showered once a week if my mother managed to make me. I would sleep for 16 hours a day, then I wouldn't sleep for 3 days. I couldn't tell you if it was day or night, let alone the day of the week. I felt hopeless, not even sad, just nothing. I couldn't even cry. The thought of writing was an unimaginable feat. It was a depression so low and flat that I couldn't even envision suicide as a solution. I felt like a fucking cartoon character because every time I saw myself, I was wearing the same goddamn outfit. Boxers, a white undershirt, and a burgundy robe. Plates of half-eaten sandwiches lingered on the floor, encircling my bed, piling high, and finally being taken away in the blink of an eye, just like those time-lapse montages in movies. Along with the sandwiches, the mail piled up. I had more mail than I had ever cared to receive. Every once in a while, my mother would barge in and express that I had received another letter from a publishing company. She would tell me to open it, but quite honestly, I didn't care. I knew what it was, and I could hear Lola taunting me in my head, another rejection letter. She was so sweet when we were together. Was I truly the failure she depicted me as? The clock spun, the montage continued. Winter turned into spring, then one day it came to a halt.
"Flynn," my mom yelled, "today is the day you are going to shower, shave, put on some clothes, read this letter, and rejoin society, or I'm sorry to say, I'll have to throw out your things."
My mother had never spoken to me this way. I couldn't tell if she despised me or loved me so much she felt compelled to make such grave threats, threats she was prepared to act on, given her tone. I don't know why I got up, but I did. I went to the bathroom and shut the door. I pissed and turned on the sink and shower. I opened the door and emerged a fresh, clean-shaven man. I looked in the mirror and didn't recognize what I saw. A handsome, functioning member of society. But I wiped my eyes because I felt quite the opposite.
"Eggs are getting cold,"
Mom yelled. I clunked down the stairs and took a seat in the kitchen, my eyes squinting from the bright sun shining through the window.
"There's my boy," my mom said. "I can see your face, Flynn. I love that face."
She had a big smile.
I grabbed one of the many identical letters from our little mail area next to the rotary phone by my mom's recliner. Another rejection letter. We regret to inform you. I opened another letter.